This is Liberty Law Talk, part of Liberty Fund's online library of law and liberty. Your host is Liberty Fund fellow Richard Reinsch. Our web address is libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org. Today we are talking with Jonathan Adler, the Johann Verheij Memorial Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation, the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. We're talking with John today about his new book that he's edited, a collection of essays called Business and the Roberts Court. John Adler has also written a book called Rebuilding the Ark, New Perspectives on the Endangered Species Act Reform. His work has appeared in the Harvard Environmental Law Review and also the Supreme Court Economic Review. And in the much more popular publication, he's also appeared in the Wall Street Journal and also in the USA Today. He's a contributing editor to National Review Online. And also many of you will know him from the Volokh conspiracy. John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So thinking about the book, Business and the Roberts Court, I'm sort of thinking about the introduction you write to the book. What would it mean to have a pro-business Roberts Court? Because as you note, a lot of commentators have noted, and I take it that's a large part of the occasion for the book, that the Roberts Court is in fact pro-business. And so I guess, as you say, analytically, the big problem is, how do we even know what that means?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, almost from the very beginning of the Roberts Court, you know, within a year or two of John Roberts and Samuel Alito being confirmed to the Supreme Court, we began to see news stories and commentaries saying that the court was pro-business and was particularly sympathetic to or open to arguments made by or on behalf of various business interests. And, you know, the label pro-business necessarily suggests, you know, well, compared to what? And what do we mean? Do we mean that the court's looking more favorably at briefs filed by business groups? Do we mean that the court adjusts its doctrines or its holdings to benefit the interests of identified business organizations or some broad conception of what is good for business? Do we mean perhaps simply that the court has other doctrinal commitments, commitments to how it reads statutes or how it interprets certain constitutional provisions that happen to line up with what business groups may want or may help business groups? So part of the point of this book was to really try and unpack this slogan that would be thrown around when folks say the Roberts Court is pro-business. Say, well, what do we mean by that? And then secondarily to say, okay, well, once we kind of have fleshed out at least what we might mean by that, what can we say about what the Roberts Court is actually doing in areas that we might broadly characterize as business law or legal questions that relate to business? And, you know, here again, I think part of the point of the book is that it, you know, it's more complicated than, you know, the hashtag slogan would suggest. There isn't evidence that the court cares about business as such. There are some areas in which the court does have a tendency that does seem to benefit what we might characterize as business interests, but there are also other areas in which the court doesn't seem to have much concern about what benefits business at all. And then I guess kind of the big takeaway, or, you know, kind of the what I hoped people would ultimately get from the book, is that if we want to understand the court, if we want to know, you know, be able to talk intelligently and think intelligently about what the court is actually doing, and have a sense of how it might decide future cases, we want to get away from the slogans and the simple labels, and we actually want to look under the hood and get a more detailed and nuanced understanding of what sorts of doctrinal commitments the court does and doesn't have. And, you know, that's kind of the broader project of the book, and I think it applies not just here. I think it applies more broadly when we're talking about labeling the work of a court as left or right, liberal or conservative, you know, pro-business, anti-business, and so on, is that those labels don't really tell us very much about the things we actually care about.
Yeah, it's interesting in this regard, thinking about, you know, what, so if one wanted to argue this is a pro-business court, what are the best sets of arguments you can make? I take it, you're thinking about this 2013 study, Lee Epstein, William Landis, and Judge Richard Posner, and they profiled business decisions, I think, from 1946 up till maybe what, 2010 or so. And they argued that the Roberts Court was the most sympathetic court to business since 1946. And this is a longitudinal study that, if I remember correctly, is just looking at verdicts or looking at empirical evidence of how the court comes out. That seems to me, on a surface read, very compelling evidence. Also, I thought it was interesting, and I forget who noted this in the book, and maybe you can fill in some details for us. The overall caseload of the court has declined dramatically. And yet I think it's during the Roberts Court we've had an increased number of business cases on the docket. So maybe those two things, we could talk about those.
Sure. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there. So let me unpack it kind of piece by piece. So first, I think most of the efforts to substantiate the claim that the Roberts Court is pro-business typically adopt one of two techniques. One, the kind of the simple-minded one, and this is not what the Epstein, Landis, and Posner study does, or I refer to it as ELP, which may remind some listeners of that old prog rock group. But you know, their study is an example, I think, of a more sophisticated and thoughtful way of trying to figure out whether the court is pro-business. The more simple-minded way is to simply point to a case in which, you know, a individual worker or consumer lost to a large corporation and say, aha, you know, the court didn't side with this very sympathetic plaintiff. They must be pro-business. And we certainly see that kind of news story or opinion piece all the time. We're being treated to lots of those sorts of stories right now in the context of the pending Supreme Court nomination. And I think those sorts of characterizations are easy to dismiss because they tend to cherry-pick cases that fit a predetermined narrative. The more sophisticated way of suggesting the Roberts Court is pro-business, and this has been done in various ways, is to try and do so quantitatively. So to, you know, say, look, of course, one case by itself doesn't tell us anything. We want to look at the full run of cases. If there are enough cases over enough period of time, we might be able to make broad generalizations about the tendency of the court. And this has been done in various ways. So initially, for example, in a piece in the New York Times Magazine written by Jeff Rosen called Supreme Court Incorporated, that it was noted that there was a series of antitrust cases and in which corporations had won every case in the first, I guess, eight or so that the Roberts Court heard in the antitrust area. But the problem, of course, is that all but one of those cases were a business versus a business.
Yeah, right.
So a business had to win.
And frequently, businesses might be rooting for a particular application of antitrust law.
Quite right.
Yeah.
The next set of quantitative efforts focused on the involvement of particular parties. So there have been a bunch of analyses focusing on the role of the Chamber of Commerce. And the Chamber of Commerce over the last 15 or so years has become an increasingly active participant in the Supreme Court, increasingly active in filing amicus briefs, particularly at the certiorari stage when the court is considering whether to take a case. And we may want to talk about this later.
Yeah.
They have played a role in kind of the evolution of the Supreme Court bar, and that certainly affects some of the things we're talking about.
We're saying a more sophisticated group of lawyers defending business interests have gotten involved in the past decade and a half.
Yes.
Didn't previously exist. That all, but which makes sense. Yeah.
Okay. Right. And the Chamber of Commerce, as a repeat player, has decided that it can advance its interests or the interests of its members by utilizing the Supreme Court bar more aggressively. And so whereas the Chamber of Commerce historically may have occasionally simply filed a symbolic brief and not really worried about trying to have an influence, Today, the Chamber of Commerce is really a very engaged, active participant, often filing briefs written by some of the premier members of the Supreme Court bar, particularly at the certiorari stage, but also, I think, being a very strategic player. And so one of the problems with just focusing on the Chamber of Commerce and its records of wins and losses is that the Chamber of Commerce, on the one hand, is most likely to file a brief where there is a consensus in the business community because it represents businesses across a wide range of industries. But on the other hand, the Chamber of Commerce, as an association that is dependent upon the contributions of and support of its members, is something of a strategic player as well. And so you can often find cases where the stakes for the business community are significant, are quite high, but the Chamber of Commerce doesn't get involved in, either because the effects are not broad enough in terms of the effects on the business community, or because the Chamber of Commerce appears to have made a judgment that the case is a loser no matter what, and that why file a brief if you're not going to affect the outcome? Instead, husband your resources to support a brief in a case where it might help make the difference. And so that's going to load the dice a little bit, right? If you have a strategic actor that refrains from participating in cases in which they're likely to lose, that's going to make their success rate look higher than it might otherwise be. Then kind of the third, I guess, wave of quantitative of studies is well represented by, or I guess the third wave is a study by Lee Epstein, William Landis, and Richard Posner, a sequel to which is coming out very shortly. And what they sought to do is say, okay, we're not going to simply look at the involvement of the Chamber of Commerce. We're going to look at this, you know, wide range of cases, and we're going to look at cases in which business was involved, and we are going to use a fairly standard kind of political science methodology in terms of determining who wins or loses, or what the outcome is. And if the business side wins, we're gonna say that's pro business outcome. If the business side loses, then it's not. In terms of their study, there are a bunch of issues. In the introduction and in some blogging that I've done, I note some methodological concerns I have with their study that make me concerned about the way they select cases and the way they characterize them. Unless you really want me to, I won't get into that nitty gritty. Let's just say, you know, when you're looking at which cases to include and which cases not to include, there are you have to be really careful, and there are trade-offs involved. And so one concern I have is that they only select cases that in which a business is the first named party on one side or the other. And that means in a lot of very large complex cases in which interest groups and states and other entities might also be involved, those cases might wash out of the study. And there are reasons to, you know, their response would be, well, there's no reason to believe that those sorts of cases are particularly clumped in one area or another. I'm actually not sure that's right. I think there are reasons to think that might, because of the types of litigation we see at different points in time, that might make, say, the Roberts Court look more or less pro-business compared to the Rehnquist Court. Yeah. So that's one set of concerns.
It's interesting, too, just thinking about your chapter on environmental law, where commentators would note, businesses seem to be winning at the Roberts Court on these environmental law questions, and yet you note it's, and yet you kind of say, but see, Massachusetts versus EPA.
Right.
Which is an incredible opinion in its own right. And, you know, interesting, curious to know your thoughts. How are we even now dealing with the consequences from that opinion on the economy?
Sure. So, yeah. So let me kind of, I'll connect these two points. The ELP study says, well, the business side wins more frequently now than it has in any prior era, right? More as defined by chief justices on the court. Another concern about that kind of study is that it treats all cases the same. But we know all cases are not the same. We know that, you know, the the plurality of cases that the court hears any given term are unanimous. They're important in the sense that they address legal questions that matter to ongoing litigation and matter to the practice of law, but they're not the cases that make the front page of the New York Times. They're not the cases that transform whole industries. Those are a small fraction of cases. And if we treat them all the same, we risk a situation in which we get a quantitative result that is different from the qualitative result. And environmental law is a really good example of this phenomenon, and Massachusetts versus EPA, I think, actually can be used to illustrate multiple potential flaws with simply crunching the numbers
Court. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking about, I mean, and I don't know what you would think about this. It seems to me the court, you know, when the public interacts with it, it's these hot button social cultural cases where, in my opinion, the court is not at its best. And but I'm wondering, you know, question for you on these business law cases, and thinking about the earlier question on, you know, the increased number of business cases on the court docket. Is this actually a case where the court acts or transcends sort of, you know, conventional partisan divisions and sort of does, there is sort of more of a consensus on how these questions should be decided? And so they're actually increasingly willing to grant, you know, review of these cases.
Well, I think there is some of that. So, So in terms of business cases, you find a lot of business cases that are decided by lopsided margins, 8-1, 7-2, and so on. I think that happens a lot of times because in many of these cases, the proper answer is rather clear. And the sorts of jurisprudential questions that divide the justices in the social context or in some other contexts may not divide them as much. There are some areas of business law, though, where you do see 5-4 decisions. Massachusetts versus EPA was certainly one. There have been some preemption cases that were 5-4. Sometimes there are statutory interpretation cases that involve the ability of certain types of plaintiffs to sue corporations, where you may often see a 5-4 split. But you do in the business area see a fair number of cases that are decided by pretty overwhelming majorities. And as you noted, the court, as at the same time as the court has shrunk the overall size of the docket, hearing now about 70 cases a year, that's half as many as, say, 30 years ago, the share of those cases that we might characterize as business-related has gone up. I think part of that may reflect the fact that the court realizes that those cases actually matter for firms and individuals being able to order their affairs and to make decisions and enter contracts, that knowing what the law actually does and doesn't require is necessary for that sort of activity to go on, right? We need a stable, predictable set of legal rules in order for private activity to flourish. I also think the court has become increasingly focused on hearing those cases that it feels it has to take as opposed to the cases it wants to take. So a higher percentage of the cases it hears are circuit splits below, where lower courts have disagreed, and the business community has been very effective at finding those cases and identifying them and highlighting them to the court and saying, hey, you really have to resolve these cases. Interestingly enough, the business community is most aggressive at doing that when it has a case that's the wrong, what they think of as the wrong side of the circuit split. And so, you know, I think a disproportionate number of those cases also end up being the court reviewing what we might characterize as liberal or anti-business or what have you, lower court opinions, which also, I think, loads the dice or stacks the deck in terms of the final outcome, because the court overturns the decision below about 60% of the time. And if most of the business-related cases it's taking are cases where there's been an aggressive push to hear what we might characterize as an anti-business ruling, well, that's going to affect the sample of cases that the court reviews. But that phenomenon is definitely occurring, and I think the justices definitely feel that it is important for them to resolve circuit splits. That's one of the most important things that the Supreme Court does, is to help ensure that federal law is uniform. And its attention to that, I think, has meant that it also spends more time thinking about details in various statutes that regulate business activity or the procedures that must be followed when in certain types of litigation. And businesses tend to care about those sorts of questions because their money's on the line. And in a way that, you know, some of the big social controversies, again, attract the headlines or things we like to talk about, but don't always have the same practical impact on business entities.
Yeah, interesting too. I mean, thinking about the Obama administration, and many people have noted not in business cases has this argument been made, but how frequently they would lose, particularly controversial issues, and they would lose unanimously. In thinking about the victories that noted here by like the Chamber of Commerce lawyers. During the Obama administration, was any of that just regulatory overreach on the part of the administration in terms of that winning percentage?
Some. I mean, one thing that I think people should realize is that as a general matter, the Solicitor General does really well in the Supreme Court. So the Solicitor General is the office that represents the federal government before the Supreme Court. And they're a repeat player, and they tend to have a pretty high win rate. What's interesting is that one of the chapters in the book by Brad Chundiff notes that when the Solicitor General's office and the Chamber of Commerce are on the same side, the win rate is really tremendous. It exceeds 80%, at least in the time period that Brad looked at. That's remarkable. And now the interesting thing is that during the Bush administration, the Solicitor General's office and the Chamber of Commerce tended to agree a lot. In the Obama administration, they tended to agree a bit less. We also saw, as you noted, in some areas, the Obama administration taking more aggressive positions than the Solicitor General's office might historically have taken in certain areas. Now, I don't think you see that as much in the business law area as you do in some other areas. There are some prominent cases involving religious liberty, the appointments clause, or the power to make recess appointments, where you definitely saw the Obama administration staking out a legal position that seemed to be quite aggressive for the federal government and more aggressive than one would have thought the court was likely to uphold. But in a lot of the areas covered by the book, you don't see that quite as much, perhaps because the cases are lower profile. The Solicitor General's office has tended to take positions that are kind of more in line with what you would expect the federal government to take. You know, the Obama administration, a little more pro-regulatory, a little more pro-plaintiff than, say, the Bush administration, but still kind of within a range of what you would expect from that office.
Yeah, a thread that I think I discerned in the book amongst several different contributors is, and particularly in your chapter on the environmental law, but I think also in Rick Hill's chapter on federal preemption doctrine, also the one on antitrust, is the notion, it's not that the court is particularly interested in the subject area, or that there's a majority behind an activist majority in pushing a certain line, or even that there's a court, that the court itself is interested in the business law, but there's something else they're after. There's a legal doctrine that they're interested in. And in some way, it's intersecting with these issues in certain ways. It seems to me that comes across in the federal preemption area, but also, and you noted, I think it was your, or maybe it was Rick Hill's, mostly in the I think it was mostly in the preemption where I kind of detected that there's a willingness or a desire to get something right. And that sort of seems to be driving certain outcomes.
Well, I think that that's true. And I mean, the one juxtaposition that I found really interesting in doing the book was actually between the environmental chapter and the securities law chapter. So Adam Pritchard writes on securities that the Roberts Court appears very interested in securities law because it takes lots of securities law cases. But when you actually look at the cases and read the opinions, there's not much about securities in the opinions. Environmental law is the same sort of thing in that, you know, there's a decent number of environmental law opinions, but you don't have many cases that talk much about the environment at all. You have Justice Stevens' majority opinion in Massachusetts versus EPA. You have one of his dissents that has some environmental rhetoric. But otherwise, when you read these cases, the only way you know they're about something environmental is because the name of the statute involved is, you know, the Clean Air Act or something like that, or because the Environmental Protection Agency is a party. There's in both these areas, what you see is while the court is active in that field, it's not engaging with the subject matter as if the subject matter is special. Yeah. It's engaging with the subject matter from the standpoint of, okay, we have a statutory interpretation question. How do we interpret statutes? There's broad agreement on the court about how to interpret statutes kind of as a first order matter. But then when text becomes not particularly clear, when you get certain sorts of outcomes, the unanimity on the court breaks down. And the splits you see in these areas are the splits you would predict based on what we know about how the justices interpret statutes, not based on their views of securities regulation, not based on their views of environmental protection. And that's what's so interesting because, you know, in the 1970s, for example, you had justices like Justice Powell, who cared a lot about securities law. He'd worked in that field. He wrote a lot of securities law opinions, and his knowledge, expertise, and concern for the subject matter, you know, was palpable. You could see it in the opinions. Similarly, in the environmental area, there were justices that really, you know, wrote about the importance of environmental values as something distinct and that need to be considered in their own way. You don't, in both these areas, you don't see that in the Roberts Court. You instead see a court that says, here's how we approach regulations. Here's how we approach statutes. Here's how we approach the ability to sue or standing or whether there's an implied cause of action. And, you know, to me, that suggests something of a more lawyerly court, right? It's focusing on the legal question.
That's Roberts' approach, though, right? Is that his influence there? Yeah.
I think it's certainly in part his influence, yeah. But you know, it's we don't want to focus on the underlying policy question about, you know, what kind of environmental protection we should have or what kind of securities law we should have. We want to focus on the legal questions of, given the statute Congress enacted, how should we interpret that? Under what circumstances do we assume that there's a private right of action? Under what circumstances do we assume that a regulation operates in one way as opposed to another? And you know, as you noted, I do think that suggests that they're trying to get the legal answers right. The other thing I think this does is it makes the court adopt a posture that's very much trying to properly interpret and apply what Congress did, and not so much second guess what Congress did, and with the belief that if they get it wrong, Congress will fix it. Right? We've never recognized this type of securities class action before. If Congress wants to authorize it, we'll obviously observe that or follow that, but it's not our job to make that policy judgment about whether or not there's too much or too little securities litigation. We're going to interpret the statute we have. Congress will fix it. Not our job to decide precisely how this particular environmental statute could or should have been written differently. We're going to apply what Congress actually did and let Congress fix it. And you see that pattern across a wide range of areas.
That's interesting. Maybe this is more of an aside, but that really makes the Massachusetts versus EPA opinion stand out all the more.
Yes.
It seems to me that, I mean, I guess I, you know, I, as you make the point, they ignored or they dismissed Chevron deference and said to the EPA, no, 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 you're interpreting the statute wrongly, even though it clearly doesn't contemplate something like greenhouse gas regulation. Right. That's an incredible thing.
Oh yeah, it was a massive decision with tremendous impacts. I mean, it led to the largest expansion of the EPA's regulatory authority in the nation's history, and resulted in a dramatic number of very far-reaching environmental regulations. And reasonable people can disagree about whether or not those regulations are a good or bad idea, about whether the EPA should be focused on greenhouse gases, and if so, what the best way to deal with them is, and so on. The court essentially said, well, even though Congress didn't realize it was addressing this, it did, and EPA has this authority. And you know, in terms of a case with the practical impact of a single business-related case, it's hard to think of one that has had a more significant impact on kind of just day-to-day business activity.
But some businesses, I mean, other businesses won.
Oh, sure. There were businesses that filed amicus briefs. I mean, one of the things I try and point in the book is that, you know, eventually we, you know, and certainly in my chapter and other chapters, we say, okay, we can make broad generalizations about what is pro or anti-business. But even in a case like Massachusetts versus EPA, there are businesses that stand to benefit from government regulation. And they did file briefs with the court. And it's not, you know, to characterize a case as pro or anti-business, it, no matter how we define the term, it is necessarily somewhat reductionistic and overly simplistic, because in many, if not most of the areas in which we're talking about, there are business entities that on both sides. I mean, even in employment cases, right? There are consulting firms and the like which stand to benefit from more stringent rules on employers. So even there is a business group that we may think that they're purely engaged in rent seeking, but there are still business groups that stand to benefit. And so when we use these terms, again, no matter how we define them, we have to note that we're being somewhat simplistic and reductionistic in adopting a label.
Curious. I mean, just continuing this line of thought here, going off topic a bit. I take it Massachusetts EPA ultimately was the basis of the Obama regulatory initiative towards the end of his presidency against green. But thinking now, so where the Trump administration says they're going to repeal those, can they really do that given this opinion?
Well, it's hard. So Massachusetts versus EPA said a bunch of things. I mean, it's easier for states to sue the federal government. It held that greenhouse gases constitute air pollutants for purposes of the Clean Air Act, at least for certain parts of the Clean Air Act. The court has had to walk that back a tiny bit in a later case. And that in deciding whether or not to regulate greenhouse gases, the court said that the EPA can only consider and must focus on the factors that Congress identified, which is the potential for the accumulation of the pollutant in question to endanger public health and welfare. And in doing so, my view has been is that the court said, although it didn't say EPA, you must now regulate, it essentially made it virtually impossible for the EPA to reach any conclusion other than that it must regulate. And so then that triggered a series of actions. So the first thing is what we call the endangerment finding. This is the initial determination that the accumulation of greenhouse gases do in fact pose this threat, or the EPA can reasonably anticipate that they pose this threat. That then triggered regulations on emissions from motor vehicles, so greenhouse gas emission standards from cars and trucks. The EPA then said that because the term, the definition of pollutant is generally presumed to be uniform, then also triggers regulation of stationary sources, so factories, utilities, and so on. The EPA realized that if it were actually to apply the Clean Air Act as written, that would actually mean it would have to regulate a universe of entities orders of magnitude larger than anything it has ever done before, and that there was no way it could do that. And so it tried to rewrite portions of the Clean Air Act to get around that, and that case went to the Supreme Court. It's a case called UARG, and there the court refused to reconsider Massachusetts versus EPA and said, well, as a general matter, yes, we're going to assume that that pollutant does include greenhouse gases, but there are some contexts in which the EPA, we're going to say that that pollutant does not include greenhouse gases, because that would force the EPA to do stuff that that it can't do, and we don't want to read the statute that way, and we can't let the EPA rewrite the statute itself. And so that's then that would lead to a set of regulations on really large emitters of greenhouse gases. The next thing the Obama administration then thought to do was something called the Clean Power Plan,
right,
which is a more ambitious, broad regulation of greenhouse gases from the energy sector or from utilities, and that involves not only is that premised on Massachusetts versus EPA, it's also premised on a very aggressive interpretation of some very poorly written and poorly amended portions of the Clean Air Act. And the Supreme Court will probably eventually hear that case, unless the Trump administration does something about it. The problem for the Trump administration is that the way you undo a regulation is basically to go through the exact same process you went through to create the regulation. And so if the Obama administration spent months and months developing the Clean Power Plan because of how large and complex it is, it's very hard for a subsequent EPA to simply wipe that away. They've got to go through this same extensive process. The Supreme Court has been quite clear and quite consistent about that, that deregulatory initiatives are not treated any differently than regulatory initiatives. And, once a regulation is in place and on the books, that's the new baseline. And the process that we impose is based on a change in the status quo, not merely an increase in regulation. And so it could be very difficult. And and the courts.
So I take it this would not fall under the Congressional Review Act. Easy repeal I've been reading so much about.
I'm pretty sure the Clean Power Plan was
they followed all the formal procedures.
They followed the rules and they followed those rules, and it was done early enough to escape the window of the Congressional Review Act. But this is a problem generally. I mean, this, you know, something else about how this relates to the way the court deals with business cases. One thing I point out in the book is that the court is much more of a shield for business than a sword. What I mean by that is that you can find lots of opinions in which the court is beating back innovative ways of reading statutory language that no one had thought of before, or really creative efforts by plaintiffs' lawyers to come up with a new way of filing a class action. You find lots of cases where the court says, no, you know, we're not going to greenlight this new idea, go to Congress. But when business comes into court and say, this thing that's out there that we've been living under, this type of class action or this type of regulation or whatever is really problematic for us, please make it go away, the court has shown no interest in that. The court has this kind of status quo bias, which protects business from entrepreneurial litigation, from aggressive plaintiffs' lawyers, but doesn't really help business roll back any existing plaintiffs' litigation or existing regulatory threats.
Yeah, which could make, I guess, although Gorsuch could be interesting in this regard.
Yes.
Some concurring opinions or some dissenting opinions, I suppose, would be interesting.
Right. Yeah. But there's still only one, he'll still
two
only
votes.
Be...
Two votes. One,
right.
Well, maybe Thomas.
Chief Justice Thomas, perhaps, on some of those points.
Yeah.
But the court overall, and this, I think, is part of Chief Justice Roberts' influence, has been a fairly status quo court. It's also, been really reluctant to adopt broad sweeping arguments, particularly in kind of the business and regulatory area. And so one example of this is in the area of punitive damages. Under the Rehnquist Court, you had a handful of opinions in which the court had said that punitive damages that are too large, that are excessive, actually violate the Due Process Clause, that there is a constitutional limit on the size of punitive damage awards in relation to the underlying compensatory damages. The Roberts Court had an opportunity to reaffirm that in a case involving the Valdez oil spill and litigation that's still ongoing and involving Exxon. And Exxon had argued that some litigation should have been preempted. The court did not accept that argument. It then said, well, the punitive damages are too large. And the court said, well, we agree, but only because this occurs under admiralty, the federal common law, of maritime disputes. And there is this notion of proportionality. And some of the justices that joined that opinion went out of their way to say, we are not reaffirming or extending the idea that there is a constitutional limit. That we're only saying this limit exists in this small context, a context in which cases rarely arise. And you know, you see the same thing, I think, in the regulatory area. The Roberts Court has shown no indication that it's going to make it easy for a Trump EPA or any deregulatory EPA to unwind existing regulations, show no indication that it's going to be sympathetic to business cases that are trying to roll back regulations that have long been on the books, but has shown some willingness to put a brake on really aggressive regulatory initiatives, particularly if they appear to be stretching statutory text or deviating from the way regulatory agencies have traditionally acted. And so the court's helped on defense, not so much on offense. And so
to delay is to live, though.
Yes. Oh, look, defense matters, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in a case like the Walmart versus Dukes case, the largest class action ever filed, the plaintiffs basically have this idea that we could use statistical evidence and we don't really have to show you that all of the plaintiffs have the common interests and commonalities that are usually required in a class action. And the court said, whoa, we've never seen this beast before. No. Last term, there was another class action case involving a case called Tyson, where there was also an effort to use some statistical evidence in terms of certifying the class, but it was a much less aggressive case. It was much more in line with things we had seen in the past, and the court said, this is the sort of thing that we're used to. This is the sort of thing that's happened before. We don't read our Walmart opinion to eliminate this type of lawsuit. It was really just that really aggressive outlier case that was the problem. And that's a pattern we see over and over.
It's interesting you talk about aggression here. So thinking about one of the most important cases that probably has fed the idea of a pro-business court, that's Citizens United. And thinking about the contributor Joel Gora's chapter in the book, and so the court does get aggressive there. It's seen as being aggressive on behalf of business interests and allowing them to participate and perhaps distort the political process in their favor. Gora argues, though, the court is aggressive on behalf of constitutional free speech as it applies to businesses. And they're really trying, he argues, they're trying to clear away a lot of new ways that various governments, state governments, had tried to sort of chip away at Buckley v. Valeo by enacting new rationales for limits.
Sure.
And so I thought that was interesting. I mean, I thought that chapter, and that also kind of touches on something we've been discussing, which is it's not the court trying to affect a business law outcome. There are other legal doctrines at play.
Right. So one of the points that Joel makes, and I think this is very accurate, is that this court is a very speech protective court, right? It's protected lies about military service. It's protected grossly offensive protests at military funerals. It's protected films that depict animal cruelty.
Video games.
It's Violent video games. I mean, this is a court that has a very expansive notion of what speech and expression are, and has rebuffed all manner of efforts to restrict speech. The exceptions have really only come in cases involving government employees and students, which are kind of special and more complicated cases. But as a general matter, the court has been incredibly speech protective, largely driven by Justice Kennedy, who has in this area a particular libertarian streak. He both is very committed to protecting speech and expression in all forms. He also is not at all any kind of minimalist in this area. That is, when he writes an opinion on the First Amendment, it will be filled with soaring rhetoric, expansive language. His opinions don't trim away at the margins. His opinions, take out an axe and just start swinging at government impositions on speech and expression. And so when you see the full range of First Amendment cases, Citizens United fits in as this is another form of speech and expression, or another context in which the government tries to restrict speech and expression. It happens to be a context in which folks on the political right tend to be more concerned about the regulations than folks on the left. But Justice Kennedy and the kind of the court over the last 10 years really hasn't cared about whether or not speech or expression is the sort that the left or the right cares about more. This court tends to care about all of it, tends to care about all of it very expansively. And so there's nothing in the court's jurisprudence on the First Amendment that suggests any particular solicitude for businesses as businesses, or even any particular solicitude for the sorts of speech that might relate to business in some way. It has a solicitude towards speech and expression. It just so happens that in a case like Citizens United, and there's another case which called Sorrell, which is a commercial speech case, that those cases happen to fit under this broader umbrella of very expansive protection of expression. And that's what's driving the court. And I think, if we want to talk about Citizens United, whether one likes or dislikes the opinion, or likes or dislikes the way we deal with campaign finance, if we really want to understand what this court is doing, we have to understand that case not as a business case, because that's not how the court saw it. The court saw that case as a case about expression and political expression in particular. And this is a court that has very strong commitments about that, even if it doesn't have particularly strong commitments about business.
Interesting. Joel Gora made the point in the chapter, which does have a pro-business effect, and that is by way of this regulatory rationale that emerged, that somehow it became okay to regulate expenditures of businesses because they have so much money, or they have so much market power. They could do things like buy up all the airwaves. They could distort the political process in a way other actors could not. And it seems that the court really, Gore asked the question, what's the limiting principle there and that doctrine? You could apply that in a lot of ways. You could apply it to media corporations. You could apply it, seems to me, to the truly eloquent who have the ability to command airwaves. And the court really knocks that down.
Oh, yeah.
And that isn't crucial,
I mean, I think the court recognizes that is a fairly... The idea that the government can decide that one set of speakers has disproportionate influence, and that therefore the remedy must be limiting them is, in my view, at least, a very dangerous principle. Note, the court doesn't say that the government can't give voice to underrepresented views itself, right? The court has not done anything to really limit the ability of the government as speaker to put forward a message with its own funds or with tax dollars and so on. The court has not gotten in the way of that. It's merely saying you can't use this rationale to suppress the speech of others or to limit the speech of others. And I think, as Joel notes, that idea is one that could be very dangerous and used in a lot of contexts in a way that, that could have far-reaching and troubling effects.
Interesting, too. I mean, just your question on the outrage Citizens United. I mean, obviously, the well-known State of the Union moment where Barack Obama chastised the court for the opinion, I think will always live in my mind because Alito shook his head no. I thought that was great. But thinking about that, the opinion also empowered labor unions to spend. And also, it seems to me the chief effect has really been sort of the rise of a new form of political action committee. And so it's like we're getting more stuff in the mix now rather than less. Just the outrage seems to me, I don't get it. And I think it must be because the wrong kinds of people can now play and we don't want them playing.
Well, I think the outrage is also, and this happens in a lot of complicated cases, that the outrage is often premised on a misunderstanding of the case, right? So a lot of people talk about Citizens United
corporations as people,
about, right? Yeah. Well, and if it were about corporate contributions to campaigns as opposed to independent expenditures, and it's not about General Motors being able to write a check to a candidate. It's about an entity that is incorporated, whether that's General Motors or the Sierra Club or the New York Times, being able to spend money promoting an issue or a question that benefits a candidate independently. I mean, there was, at the original Citizens United argument, there was this key point at which the Solicitor General was asked whether or not, under their theory, the government could prohibit or limit the publication of a book that was published by a book publisher, right, which are all corporations, because at the end of the book, it urged folks to support or oppose a political candidate. And the Solicitor General, consistent with the government's theory, really had no choice but to answer yes. And that, I think that was a pivotal moment in the litigation, because that showed how sweeping the government's theory was. But it's not just Citizens United. I mean, another case that got sparked a lot of outrage is the case of Lilly Ledbetter, case about disparate pay. And we can argue about whether or not companies should be required to meet certain requirements or and the like. We can argue about what types of litigation should or should not be allowed. But that case is often presented as she toiled for years and years and years, and finally one day discovered that she was being paid unequally and went to sue, and she was told too late. And what this means is that this is a problem because people won't know. Well, it turns out she actually knew. She just hadn't filed suit for whatever reason for a long period of time. So the scenario that people talked about, the scenario that the dissent in the opinion focuses on, is one that wasn't at issue. Rather, the case was a fairly mundane case about the way we interpret a particular statute and whether or not...
Discovery under statute of limitations, right?
The court actually said the question of when the conduct was discovered was not at issue. The question was whether or not, when you're challenging it, are you challenging the decision to give or not give the raise, or does the statute of limitations essentially toll every time you get a paycheck, because each paycheck that embodies the disparate pay is a new violation. Ledbetter was arguing the latter, but had acknowledged in the litigation that it was not a case of her having been unaware. And there's a footnote of the majority saying we're not addressing the case in which the corporate decision was made many, many years ago, but the employee never knew. And the reason that was a separate footnote is because there are all kinds of contexts in which courts say we're not going to hold against the plaintiff failing to act if the plaintiff couldn't act because they didn't know. There are lots of contexts in which we toll the statute of limitations or we impose a discovery rule. That wasn't an issue in the case. And yet, you look at most popular discussions of the case, they talk about a scenario that wasn't before the court. And unfortunately, we see that a lot in these areas. We see caricatures of the questions the court is dealing with, as opposed to the actual dispute before them.
John Adler, thank you so much for your time and for coming on the program to discuss this new book that you've edited, Business and the Roberts Court. I appreciate it greatly.
My pleasure.
This is your host, Richard Reinsch, and you have been listening to a podcast that can be found at libertylawsite.org, where you can subscribe, comment, and find other episodes and links related to today's conversation. Our email address is lal@libertyfund.org.